Welcome to DivCasts from the University of Chicago Divinity School. For more of our podcasts and information about our terms of use, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts.
I'm just going to announce today, yes, I'm so thrilled that they could be here. Today we have two guests speaking for the same price as one. We have Professor Kristen Schilt and Chase Joint. Professor Schilt is Assistant Professor of Sociology, and Chase Joint is a multimedia artist. They're conducting a year-long collaborative project exploring the construction of public narratives about transgender identity. I think I'm just going to leave the introduction at that because I want to make sure we get through the presentation. Trans asterisks. So please join me in welcoming our guests.
Thank you.
Where'd our paper go?
Great. Thank you so much. We're so excited to be here. So we're going to get started with just a little bit of background on us. We go ahead and put this up here. So I am a sociology professor, and I do research on a lot of topics pertaining to life experiences of transgender people. So my first book focused on the workplace experiences of transgender men, and this is work that I have continued on as I'm moving through my career.
I'm a multimedia artist and filmmaker. I'm also trans-identified, but one of the things that we like performatively and playfully doing with this footnote is sort of locating where we are in relationship to the work that we do. So we're coming at the public construction of narrative identity about trans people from very different locations. And one of the things that we have been noticing as we continue to talk in public is it's very important that I self-identify as a trans person so people understand that this information that I'm talking about is coming from some sort of lived experience. And it's equally as important for Kristen to identify as a cis person who is not coming from lived experience. And we, while thinking through how necessary and relevant those identifications are also pushing back on some of the ways in which those positionalities keep us separated and unable to think through things in more complicated ways.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about that at the end, but we just wanted to start and say we have had a year of fellowship with the Mellon Fellowship for Arts and Inquiry with the Gray Center here on campus. And this is a really unusual grant that brings an artist to work with an academic for a year. And the idea is that you do something experimental that pushes you both out of your comfort zone. So we spent a year doing that.
out of the comfort zone.
probably more so for me as a social scientist, where I'm like, how's this gonna work? Like, I don't get it. But it's okay. So we'll talk a little bit about our work at the end, but this is a collaboration that was really sort of a long time coming. So Chase and I met at UCLA when Chase was an undergraduate and I was a graduate student who TA'd a class that he was in. So who knew that that was going to lead to something like this? But this has been really kind of a fruitful part of our collaboration is the friendship that we came in with, and I think it's really allowed us to push a lot of boundaries that have been really productive.
So the title of our talk is Trans on Campus, in part because the work that we do is genuinely invested in thinking through trans representation on campus, in institutions, in communities, and what that has allowed us to do is participate in a variety of different kinds of events throughout the year that we've been together. And one of the things we often get asked to do is to perform a version of what we call Trans 101. And when I say Trans 101, can anyone like shoot out what you think that means? Does anyone already have expectations about what a Trans 101 would do?
In the classroom.
Or accomplish?
What does it mean?
What does it mean? No?
You help me feel more comfortable with
that. You can act for education in the trans with.
Right, so it's an interesting question. And the fact that there's not lots of hands is common. It's common that oftentimes content about gender non-conforming, gender variant people, subjects, histories are unknown. They don't exist on syllabi, they're not supported in programs, we don't have a ton of faculty who are specializing in these types of topics, and as such, our work often looks like performing a level of 101 training prior to talking about other issues. So it looks like broad definitions. What do we mean when we're talking about transgender people? What's the difference between transgender and transsexual? These types of questions have various answers depending on who you ask. But it's hard to have any further conversations without sort of locating the different terms that we're doing.
And we sort of joke that, you know, we're doing the Trans 101 and we want to do the Trans 1001, right? Like, we want to like it. We're way out there, but we aren't there yet. And I think part of the issue that we wanted to raise is that many times with the Trans 101, particularly in the classroom, but also outside the classroom, the onus is really on trans people to explain to other people their identity in a way that is kind of fascinating, because I think that, you know, that's typically a position that people who have what are considered sort of marginal identities are in. But trans, I think, is particularly unique in the classroom, where many students of mine who identify as trans have been in situations where a professor will say, well, I don't know anything about this, maybe you could tell us, right? And it's very rare for professors to cede authority at all times, right? So it's an interesting moment when somebody's like, I actually can't do this, right? And I think that those moments are fascinating. Like, for me in sociology, I'm always the person that, like, men will come to and say, could you teach a feminist theory lecture in my theory class? I think you'd be great, right? And it's those moments when you realize, like, oh, this person doesn't have any responsibility or feel responsible for educating other people, right? So I think that there's a burden that oftentimes is placed on transgender people in the classrooms or outside to produce this kind of one-on-one.
As a moving image artist, I like to think through these types of problematics in experimental and artistic ways. About 2 years ago, I was called by Canadian media to participate in a radio interview about various trans issues that were happening in the media at that time. And I was being interviewed alongside Nina Arsenault, who's an incredible force of a performance artist in Toronto. And we found ourselves sitting in the lobby of the national radio station after the interview, talking about how tired we were of answering the same kinds of questions over and over again, and how when we were called to actually speak about something that was happening in the media, we got trapped in sort of the circles of rhetoric that the media promotes about trans people. And I said, you know, we gotta figure out a way to disrupt this. We gotta figure out a way. And so Nina said, well, I'll just go in there and lie. Or, you know, we were like, we were thinking about funny and sort of subversive ways that we could participate in shifting public narratives. And she didn't end up going on the radio online. But what we did do is create a short video that is now traveling in festivals, and we thought we would show it to you today. This is called I'm Yours.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thanks for having me. Like a question that I want to ask you, or a question and then you're going to answer them for me, or questions that I want you to ask me.
Yeah, I got all of them.
I'm yours, sir.
My name is Nina.
My name is Chase Rangel.
Before, my name is Nina, and my name is Rodney.
I don't have to answer that question. Mostly just because people who know that name tend to start using it.
Well, I suppose that I identify in a lot of ways.
I identify as a trans man.
For a while, I identified as a witch, as a fairy, as a cyborg. I used to think that I was a transsexual.
I suppose if I was to answer that question for my mom, it would be that I was born female.
The first cut, I don't mean the first surgical cut, I mean the first cut into my psyche, the first big trauma, was maybe around 4 or 5 when I realized I was in the wrong body.
Sometimes positive.
My hope was that I would have 5 surgeries and be passable.
I think that's kind of like impossible to correlate.
The first things I did was my nose.
Working backwards, I had my elbow replaced with metal.
My chin.
I had like a mole removed.
cheek implants.
A root canal. And hysterectomy and adult incision.
And forehead shave.
You know, he does the secondary sex characteristics kind of thing.
I take hormones.
My voice is lower.
Hair extensions.
I sweat more.
Silicone.
I have at least 14 hairs on my chest.
As well as processed food. I eat protein bars.
When I bulk up, I can make these holes really deepen in a way that they were unable to deepen before.
I don't know how much my parents totally understand about my identity.
My mom is an Orthodox Jew. So there have been some complicated negotiations.
I think my dad tells me to like start listening to other people a little bit more.
I have no idea about my dad. I've never asked.
And then my mom wishes that everything wasn't so sexual.
I generally date people that I'm attracted to.
I have a girlfriend.
Yeah, I suppose when I'm feeling really bad about myself, I'll occasionally date people who just make me feel really good about myself. That generally doesn't work out very well.
Maybe I'm making the question too complicated. The answer too complicated. But the question is too simple.
What do you think is between Alex?
It was always the balls that made me feel like a man.
That is none of your business.
The costs are that a surgically altered face feels deceitful to people.
These things are not without consequences.
And yet, the only reason it's not trustworthy is because so-called natural people don't get it.
I have many, many regrets.
No, see, that's the other thing. I actually don't have regrets.
It took me a long time to figure this out.
People want me to feel shame for the choices I've made.
I think that when you fight really hard against something you... How do you answer that?
Well, my answer is this. I always loved myself. I loved myself when I was in a male body.
No, certainly not.
Yes, I also hated myself, too. There was a mingling of self-hatred and self-love.
I don't think you can ever feel complete. I feel more on track with various things that I want in my life than I ever have before.
Am I completely now resolved and like some fully formed, prepackaged human being that like now totally accepts and loves myself? No, there's new challenges all the time.
I'm not even sure I always feel like a man now.
The idea that that's considered a failure? Give me a fucking break.
You and me.
We have shown this many times now. Chase has shown it many more times without me. And audiences tend to read it in different ways, right? And there's a lot of laughter, so I'm going to guess that you read it in the way that Chase was probably closer to intending, in terms of like as a satire, the questions that people get asked when they happen to be trans. The other way that people read it is, oh my god, this is finally everything I've always wanted to know about trans people, and I just watched this like, video where I get to know the truth. And to that, we always like to say, Chase never had a root canal, so when you trust in that video.
I should hire you.
But, you know, the video, I think, we can imagine, if you watch this, that you can guess some of the questions that people would be supposedly asking off screen, right? So, and this is often what kind of happens in Trans 101. And I think, you know, I often get asked by workplaces who are considering to do trans-inclusive policies to come give one-on-ones to employees and things like that. And, you know, I think that there's complications in both, right? So I think it's not lost on me that I'm often asked because I'm not trans. And so it's somehow easier for people to feel like they can ask these questions that they're dying to know to me, who's seen as sort of an expert without the lived experience, than it might be to someone who you feel like could seem more invasive.
That brings us into our next slide. And one of the things that we thought might be generative and interesting about the talk today is to think through trans inclusion in a number of different ways. So there are institutional factors that impact our ability to have these types of conversations. So at a school level, at a company level, at a government level, there are ways in which institutions help and hinder these processes.
And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the institutional levels. And this is something that I'm always very interested in knowing about when I come to a university. So when I was considering, you know, coming here as a professor, I was really interested in what's the climate like for trans students. And ways in which I was looking at this was there a name change policy, right? So, you know, we all use this online chalkboard. So could you change your name to a preferred name? At that time, no, you couldn't, which always struck me as bizarre, where I'm like, in this online world, really, we can't figure out how to like have people change their name, which if you've been following it, we finally got it this year. This is our rollout year. That took a long time to figure out how to program that into chalk. Also things like healthcare. And so I had come out of UCLA, and you know, the University of California systems, as with many things, have been the front runners on covering healthcare for trans students. And I was really surprised that the University of Chicago had basically nothing. And last year I was asked to be on a policy group about that. And if you saw the announcement in January of this year, we now have full coverage for staff, faculty, and students. And so that was something that, you know, I've been really excited about the University of Chicago, because even though it was very behind the times in some ways, it wasn't necessarily hostility. It was more like, oh, I didn't know this was a thing. And like many things on campus, once you point out, yes, this is a thing, it can be changed, which I think is really useful. And I think that, but you know, something that the institution, I think, has to be pushed to do, because there's just a lot of things that people don't think about. You know, so I've had students have to deal with financial aid issues, where people in financial aid are like, oh, I don't know what to do if you're trans. And, you know, I'm always like, well, why do you figure it out? It's your job. But it's something that, like, you have to constantly push, you know. And I think that I've been really happy to see the institutional climate really change at the University of Chicago, but I think it's something that has to continually be pushed, instead of this idea, like, well, now we've done this thing and we can all kind of rest. Other things are housing policies, right? So we do have a policy here where you can room with someone sort of with the quote-unquote same sex or opposite sex of you as you, even though I think you can only opt in as a sophomore, which I think is somewhat fascinating, but gender-neutral bathrooms, things like that. And so, you know, I think the university always has a way to go, but those kinds of policy measures are really important in terms of signaling a trans-inclusive climate at the university level.
And so that relates quite obviously to the interpersonal ways in which we negotiate these types of shifts on campus. And so I think really critically about the construction of syllabi, for example. And we can look at the trajectory of higher education and think about how historically it's been incredibly white and incredibly male dominated. And for example, I take a lot of lead from scholars and communities of color who push curriculum into syllabi wherein communities were otherwise not represented. And it's more than this is the one week where we're going to study, you know, every minority community that we can imagine, so that we can say that we have an integrated syllabus, rather than taking, you know, 10 steps back and thinking of how to integrate on the level of the course entirely. So one of the things that I think often happens is trans content does not exist on very many syllabi, and people would say, oh yeah, but trans content's being taught in women's studies. That is not a true statement, just for the record, right? It is being pushed by Centers for Sexuality and Gender Studies, and by some curriculum in women's studies. But to say that a certain discipline is taking care of representation on behalf of an institution is a limited way of thinking about broader integration. And so if you think about attempting to represent the types of students that are on campus, that are thinking through things critically, there are ways in which trans and gender nonconforming theories, identities, people, cultural production can be integrated. And I think that also extends to the types of people who are being hired, the ways in which, you know, who is teaching these classes, how many trans people exist in positions of power or authority or teaching on campuses, and these are obviously very related conversations to be having.
And we were talking about, too, you know, interpersonal also includes the dynamics in the classroom, and so we're, you know, thinking again about how to make a more trans-inclusive environment on campus means thinking about things like students might have different preferred pronouns than you might assume based on how you read their appearance, right? And I think that, you know, this is something that instructors rarely get instruction on, like how would you incorporate this? If someone comes to you and says, I actually prefer a different pronoun now than I did when I came in, how can you handle that with the class? And I think people who come out of more gender-inclusive communities often know how to integrate that in their class because they've been in situations where people go around the room and say their preferred pronoun. Other people don't, right? And so I think it's something that we can think about in terms of how to make the classroom more inclusive, how to make that something that's a little bit more expected, so it's not just like, so-and-so has an announcement they want to make to the class, and you put your student on the spot, right? Like, how can we all sort of think this through? And, you know, Chase and I get asked to do a lot of PFLAG, Parents for Friends of Lesbians and Gays Everywhere meetings. And something that I've gone to probably every PFLAG in Illinois at this point in my life.
Can you make a t-shirt for that?
And something I really love about it is if you've never been to a PFLAG, it's mainly cisgender or people who are not transgender people who have children who are gay or lesbian, sometimes children who are trans, and sometimes they're just sort of allies. And one thing that's interesting is these people who don't necessarily know a lot about sort of gender politics are in settings where they see people doing preferred pronouns. And so you start to see, you know, these people in their 60s and 70s being like, let's all go around the room and say preferred pronouns. And it's very sweet. You know, they're like, we gotta know. Like, what if we're actually mispronouncing someone? And so the fact that these people are willing to kind of take the lead in their groups, I think is really interesting to me to see how change can happen.
So one of the things that we are asking these questions of ourselves all the time. We're not posing these questions to the room as if the room, you know, is being held accountable for something that we are not. These are the types, this is the work that we are doing all the time. And our fellowship is an exploration of ways in which to do some of this work. So they give us a little bit of money and a year and said, what could you do? And we did a number of things. We did more things than they expected. And we started the year by bringing some of my gallery installation work. This was a still from the artist talk of Resisterectomy that happened at the Gray Center, as a way in which to think through art and cultural production on a more traditional venue scale with people out on campus and beyond. While this show was up, we were teaching a class called Tell Me the Truth, The Politics of Narrative Construction, which hybridized documentary film theory and sociological interview analysis and so many other ways in which to think through narrative construction, both in the academy and beyond. And part of that class culminated in an installation called Follow Us, some of our organizers who are sitting in the front here, wherein we transformed the Gray Center for Arts and Inquiry into a blast from the past. So our students went into the archives of the University of Chicago and unearthed and unveiled various hidden and or strategically hidden and or simply historically hidden narratives from the University of Chicago and mounted it in an installation that was up for a week not too long ago.
I'm in that picture.
Because I think we have many people who are actually...
We have no waivers for anyone in this picture.
And I think, you know, one thing that's been interesting is, you know, in some ways, even though the Gray Center's mandate is to be experimental, I think that, you know, our topic was probably a little bit more experimental than they may have wanted at first, right? And part of what we could really kind of push through was I was very adamant about the idea that, you know, that as far as I knew, Chase was going to be the first transgender person in the country to receive a grant like this at an institution like the University of Chicago. And that it's really important if you want to actually change climate and be integrated to do work like this. And, you know, I think we showed this picture, I mean, this is what our event looked like, and we were so excited because I think it does show that there is kind of an appetite for this sort of material and learning on campus, particularly for things that kind of go outside of the classroom setting. And, you know, that, I think, was a really big step towards changing the climate a little bit. You know, like, we had, the same day that we were doing this, my department was having new graduate student recruitment, and I was like, oh, you want to come to this? You should. And we got like five grad students who were like, this is it, like I'm totally coming here. And I had to keep going, it's not like this all the time, like I promise. Like this is like not something that like every month I'm like, hey, we're having this awesome party. But they were like, no, it's the fact that it existed, right? Like there's something about this institution that allowed this to happen. And I think it was really meaningful. We recently went to Princeton and Chase installed Resisterectomy there. And it was another case of seeing a university where people just don't have a lot of access to this type of information or material that was really important to see.
And this is, for us, the start of a number of conversations and a number of ways of being. And we're coming to the end of my time in Chicago in a few weeks, and we're thinking a lot about ways in which to continue this work and to figure out ways to move it to other places. Chicago is one place where it can be. How else can we be moving and shaking and teaching in these types of ways? That's the end of our formal to do.
We thought we would leave it.
Yeah, or maybe like have a chat about there's tons of holes in what we're doing. We're looking to keep filling them and having conversations with people about strategies of inclusion here and otherwise. Thank you.
about on the institutional level when you were having questions about changes in policy, what were some of the tactics that you used to get people interested in doing them? Were you relying on statistics more? Were you relying on empathy? Some of the, I could think of a lot of, I just thought of the chalk. I know a lot of divorced women who've had terrible times getting their CNET ID changed.
Yes. So when I first got here, I didn't know anybody, so I relied on the policy of irritation. So I started calling people and be like, my student needs a waiver for, one of my students needed a waiver for getting financial aid about, if you are a man, you have to register with selective services, but not if you were a man who was raised as a girl. And the university was like, I've never even heard of this before. And I was like, well, I just went on the internet and found all this stuff, and you work there, so call me back in 10 minutes and tell me what the answer is. And so I did a lot of that myself. And so I would usually just tell my students, if you have a problem, come to me, and I will figure out somebody to irritate. Because I think I contacted the makers of Chalk, and they were like, oh, this is something that isn't going to work. And then I finally just went over to the registrar one day, and the registrar was like, oh my god, this is so easy. And I was like, I knew it. And then I'm not saying I'm responsible for the preferred name policy. Because then I discovered that there was a whole community of people at the University of Chicago who were really working for these issues. And so I think that, and that was really great to see, because I never thought it was a hostility issue. I thought it was just I've just never thought about this before. But
it's very fancy description of the University of Chicago.
I think it's sort of statistics. The thing that always works is, well, did you see what Harvard did? That is usually what you see. So when Harvard did all the healthcare stuff, all of a sudden it was like, we need a committee to look at this policy. So I feel like Harvard and Stanford always the things that you're like, oh my gosh, look at how great they are. And what are we doing? So.
You know, what's interesting in your question, too, is the relationship between statistics and empathy, or critical empathy, I would add to it, because that's something that we take up in our collaboration often as someone working in the social sciences, which is, founded on understandings of data and conclusions, and as a humanities moving image artist who resists all conclusions and most data, we've been having a really interesting time of figuring out how you can actually move together towards these aligned agendas using different kinds of resources, and I think the relationship between statistics and other forms of strategies for change is a really interesting one. Yes?
The inevitable question. Moving up to the national and international scene, what's your take on Chelsea Manning?
When you say, what's your take? When you say, what's your take, are you asking for something specific?
No, just general.
I think that what Chelsea Manning is doing on a public media scale is profound and important and incredibly complicated work. I think that she is fighting against a prison industrial complex that has people moving against, her quality of life and her right to self-determination. I think that she is fighting a battle that is going to be very long, and I stand in solidarity with her choice to live the life that she wants.
I agree. I love the language of inclusion and access that you were using towards the end of the talk there. And I'm interested, it reminds me a lot of other conversations on campus that can sometimes seem discrete, conversations that we've been having a lot this year about disability access, about access for students of color who feel underrepresented, especially in this complicated neighborhood and part of the city. So I was interested, how do you think that the fight for trans visibility on access, do you think that intersects with those conversations in any way? Is this a way we can rethink those conversations or maybe merge them in some way?
I think they're definitely related. I think access and inclusion, that can apply really broadly, and I think there's a lot of times when it makes sense to work together collectively to think that through. But I think there's also times where it's important to think about the specifics of what certain groups need, right? And so I think that there's a way to kind of think about working together but also apart when necessary, because I think that you don't, I think it's almost too easy for the institution to be like, oh, well, you get this building on 5710, right? And we'll put everybody who's a minority group in this one building, right? And that's great on some level, but it's also that's not the end. Right, and so I think that there's ways in which conversations need to happen together, and I think you know, the gender studies and like the Center for the Study of Race, Culture, and Politics have done really well recently at like actually having more integrated events, which I think is one way forward. So I think like that kind of having those conversations is important, like when Kim Crosby came and talking about intersectionality and how that impacts people in a variety of different ways. But I think that there's other ways in which you still need kind of like a specific focus as well.
And I think, you know, what you bring up is complicated because it assumes categories of people that are also separate from each other.
Right.
When the reality is that we have lots of bodies on campus who identify in all sorts of mm-hmm. parts of communities, right, that are intersecting and overlapping and functioning in different ways in their lives. And I think that, to me, it comes back to a level of integration on a number of different levels, right? So it can't just be social services working towards certain kinds of institutional change. It has to be reflected in the quality and the style of intellectual engagement in other parts of campus. So we need to be thinking about it in concurrent trends and not just simply from a level of student services or a level of housing. It needs to actually be far more circular.
You said that having your building is not the end. What's next? Like what's your next big issue?
Well, I didn't get the building. I'm just saying. I'm responsibility for everything. That was here before I got here. But I think that, you know, that's one way. I mean, it's nice to have space on campus, but that's like another way of saying like, this is your space on campus, right? And I think the other question is like, well, why don't we like open up campus, right? And I don't know what that looks like. You know, I think that, I think 5710 is like a great institution, and it was a really, I think it's a product of a certain kind of like political move that was really big sort of in the 1990s and the 2000s. And I think things are sort of shifting a little bit. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what happens, but I definitely think the conversations about things like, you know, inclusion on syllabi, which might sound sort of ridiculous, but it's like to think of things, you know, again, not to have like a trans week, but to mix things in, because I think what that signals is this is something that is valid, right? Like you can't just check out of this 1 week because you decided you didn't care about it, you know. And so, you know, like I teach in self-culture and society in the core. And one thing that always comes up is like, if you've ever looked at it, the entire syllabus is men, right? And it's like all white men for like three quarters until you get to Simone de Beauvoir, right? It's very and so there's a lot of discussions from people who are frustrated about, well, how do you like let's have a week where we're like, you have to talk about women. And I was like, the absolutely worst thing you can do, because the students are basically like, this can't actually be real because you're making a big deal about it. And so I always tell them, you know, I just put women on there and I don't say anything about it, you know, and I'm like, oh, we're gonna read this and this. And I've never had any pushback on it. And I think that thinking about how to be inclusive in your syllabus instead of tokenizing is really important.
Well, and what's interesting too is that we live in an academic structure that allows us to opt out mm-hmm. easily. So you can be taking classes wherein you are only learning about white people. Mm-hmm. You can take classes where LGBT will never be uttered in the form of a lecture or in a community discussion. And if you have an opportunity to move through an institution opting out of everything that might be challenging or might unsettle understandings of how we move in the world, it's going to be hard to make large change, right, from that place.
Could you say some more, each of you and together, about your approach to narrative in the course and as a motion artist and as a sociologist and the convergence and the divergence, and whether trans 1001, when it comes, will it have a new theory of narrative in it, or a new set of tools for thinking about the narrative construction of human lives?
That's a great question.
It is.
I love personal narrative. It is a strategy for me of engagement in politics. Personal narrative comes with very tricky circumstances. In the context of trans lives at an institutional level, there is a narrative that exists that one must adapt if they would like services. So there's a way in which you need to narrate your experience of being a trans person that looks like a sense of congruence, point A to point B, understanding of a self, that looks like a projection of a future that you understand, that you know you will be happy with. Great. I know that in 10 years I will be thrilled with the choices that I'm making. Like, no one could say that about their lives ever. But yet somehow we are requiring that trans people say, this transition will solve my problems and will afford me the type of life. And I think that that's a very valid, very necessary process currently, as there is no other. But so for me, as an artist working in narrative in more complicated and perhaps experimental ways, what are ways that you can disrupt the tropes of narrative making to afford potentials for other kinds of lives and experience making?
I think we were really interested in the construction of narrative, right? So in the social sciences, I do qualitative work, so I interview people, I do ethnography, and, you know, I certainly shape what is in the books, right, that I produce, or the book that I produce. And I think one thing that we often talk about is what gets left out, right? And I think things get left out for a variety of reasons. I think they're politically unpopular, right, that you feel protective of a certain identity group and you want to represent them in the best way possible. But, you know, what doesn't get told, I think, is also, you know, just as important as what does. And there's not a lot of space for having those kinds of conversations because they have political consequences. They have real life consequences.
Trans 1001 might start with the understanding that everyone's sense of gender is a constructed narrative, mm-hmm. right, and move from there, as opposed to.
Would it be an effective way to disrupt gender norms by, when meeting people, to always ask what pronouns they prefer? Is that a good thing to do?
I love that. I mean, I think that these kinds of questions are personal. I often avoid pronouns frequently and use people's names, and there are other ways of addressing people that doesn't afford that kind of conclusion making early on. And oftentimes people will, you know, if they understand that they're talking to you about something specific, will identify themselves in often gendered language eventually over time that you can pick up on. It's really easy to not use pronouns once you start doing it. Like, it really is. There's ways that you can use your first name. You can use they, a non-specific pronoun that affords a lot more movement in conversation. I think it's a great strategy. I don't think it's something that everyone would choose. That wouldn't be everyone's strategy, right? But I think it's a great way. And it's a great way to identify yourself as someone who's thinking about those things.
And I think, you know, I think one thing you can also do is, I think the thing that's difficult is people tend to want to ask what pronoun do you prefer if they read someone as potentially, like, not using a normative pronoun. And people who consider themselves sort of like, the, why would you ask me that? Like, I think it's important to kind of be able to check yourself and to, like, not take offense if someone is asking you, because I think people's reaction oftentimes is, do I not look like I'm producing the gender that I think I am? And so I think thinking about how to kind of take this as a question that is something that is going to now exist in the world, as opposed to, like, this is something directed to me. So, because I think it's a practice that once it gets more integrated, like, I would say 5 years ago, if I went around my class and had everybody prefer pronouns, like, you know, halfway through sort of break down and people would be like, what's happening? Like, what are we doing? And now, you know, most people are like, oh yeah, I've done this before, like, this is something. And of course, this is like a rarefied environment for that. But I think it's a way of thinking about, like, you know, asking other people, but then figuring out how you feel when people ask you and just kind of realizing this is, like, again, now a question that exists in the world. When we were at Princeton, at their LGBT center, they had a bunch of buttons and you could wear them and it said your pronoun on them. So it's another, you could advertise your pronoun.
Awesome.
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of them in my bag. I mean, so they had, like, you know, he, his, him, you know, on the button so people could just go around wearing their pronoun.
It's hard work, and I think, like, I want to stay on your question for a second, because we talk in these terms. What would it be like to live in this utopia where we could move around and have any kind of gender we wanted and not be patrolled by other people? You know, and I think your question about how do you integrate this? Like, is that my first question when I meet someone? What pronouns do you use? It's a stressful engagement because it brings up our sense of possibility of alienating ourselves or the other person. What does it mean to be engaged in this work? It is hard work. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I keep coming back to is that this type of work for me gets easier with more practice, right? The more integrated it becomes, the more conversations that I have with people about different ways of being, mm-hmm. the types of engagements that you're asking about become less stressful.
And I think also just learning to, you know, if you meet someone for the first time, you don't ask, and then they say, actually, I prefer they pronouns, like, not feeling like you've done this terrible thing, right? Like, learning to say, like, oh, okay, you know, you go from there, instead of, like, oh my God, I'm like a terrible person, like, I'm so sorry. Like, I think learning how to kind of roll in the world with that is also really important, and it makes that kind of interaction a lot easier.
So what you just said kind of reminded me of an experience that I and other sex women do have had, which is not so much a rejection, but just sort of a fear of using the wrong language that I think is actually has prevented me a little bit because I'm so scared of offending or of not being up to date. And I'm wondering if you have suggestions. And then also something you said earlier about how professors don't take personal responsibility for teaching, you know, the unit of their class on feminism or something. And I would suggest that, sure, I think it's an issue of responsibility, but also I think there's very much a fear of getting it wrong or of like not representing the movement correctly and like the cultural, all the things that you talk about, not representing it accurately because it's changing so quickly and there are so many different specialized language. So like, I'm just wondering if you guys have any proposals for like getting over that fear and trying to get people more comfortable with going out on a limb and showing themselves open, but not fully informed yet.
Absolutely. I think it's a great question. And it's something that I personally continue to engage in. I'm going to make mistakes in my language. I'm going to, you know, misstep about how someone identifies perhaps or the ways in which I'm summarizing my understanding of someone's work. There's lots of ways in which I think as we push, we're gonna fall, right? As we push to grow and change the way we think, we are gonna make mistakes. And my only answer is, when taking the risk, be prepared to say, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that, or that's actually not language that I was familiar with, I appreciate that. That is the first step. The second step, which is the harder one, I think. Well, no, the first step is hard. The second step is equal. The second step is to take a step back and think, I'll give an example. So I was using male pronouns for someone who was using they pronouns. And it was someone that I had existed for a long time in the world with using male pronouns. I did not realize that there was a switch. It happened in public. I was told, I apologized. They said thank you for apologizing. And then I took a step back and I thought, you need to integrate now. Because now my responsibility with the new information is to step up to the task and interact with this person in the world the way that they've asked me to interact with them, right? And so it's more than just a, I'm sorry, I move on, and then I make mistakes again and again and again. It's how can I hold myself accountable to the commitment I just made to this person and really work? And then if you slip again, you say, I'm really working on it. And you do your best.
And I think that, you know, I often start my classes off by saying, because I teach a lot of classes on gender and sexuality, and I say, you know, everyone in this room is coming with varying levels of experience and knowledge, and you're going to have all sorts of different terms and things that you prefer, and it's fine to raise that, but all I ask is that you say something like, I actually prefer this, instead of making someone feel stupid. Because I think it's when people feel stupid and shut down that they're immediately like, well, now I don't want to do that thing because I feel like stupid. Mm-hmm. And I think as much as you can stop yourself from over-apologizing and becoming the worst person ever, like, I'm sorry I did this, like, and trying to figure out how to integrate, but also thinking about if you're correcting other people, how to do it in a way that's informative, but not necessarily shaming, because I think it's that shaming that often makes people feel shut down and, like, that, you know, nobody likes to feel embarrassed, right? And so I think thinking interactionally, that said, if, like, someone continuing his pronouns, then I think a little shaming is good. But in terms of the learning process, that's something that I
really... We have different strategies.
I'll shame him for you, that's fine. But, you know, I think, you know, in the classroom is something that I really try to enforce because I think, you know, I teach people who come from a lot of different places and some people have a certain terminology that they know and other people don't. And I want to be sure people understand what's happening. And, you know, I don't ask that people change their mind or adopt certain terms, but, you know, I always tell people, like, if you say transgender with an ED on the end, I'm going to say, oh, maybe take the ED off. Like, I prefer it off, you know? And, like, thinking of ways to have a conversation about that. In terms of the being worried about not being an expert, you know, I'm somewhat unsympathetic to that because I feel like coming here, I had to teach in the core. Like, you know, I read all these things that I've never read before in my life, and I had to go lead, like, discussion with people, and that's, like, what education is for. And so I feel like if I can read like Karl Marx and like all these like old white men and be like, all right, let me tell you all about this, students. Like, I think you can learn things. And I think that's a responsibility. Like, I think, because I think it's really dangerous when as educators, we see the ability to learn in a particular kind of identity area, you know.
We are about out of time, but is there a last question?
There's not a last
one. I'll make an announcement.
Oh, okay, good.
So we're actually doing our last event together for this spring on May 14th at Gender Studies. We're doing a lunch where we're going to do what is now being called a talk performance of some of the collaborative work we've been doing with the Gray Center. So there's free lunch if anybody wants to come at noon at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies.
And on May 7th, which is the Wednesday prior, at 4:30 in the Center for Study of Gender, Center for Sexuality and Gender Studies, I am showing a work in progress of a new film, and my collaborator from Toronto will be here, and we're looking for some critical feedback if you're interested in trans cultural production and experimental film. But not in the way that you think, experiment. please join us. It would be great. There'll be food and drinks, and we would love to have a conversation.
Both of these events are at the Center for Gender.
Yes, one on the 7th, one on the 14th.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
We thank you for listening to or viewing our podcast. For more information and for other podcasts, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts. Copyright, the University of Chicago Divinity School.